Unfortunately, Mary Fiorito's scheduled guest, First Amendment attorney Eric Niffen, who was to talk about the First Amendment and religious freedom, will be rescheduled. We'll let you know when that will happen on Facebook and on Winds of Change.
We marvel and flatter such meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide. The winds have changed.
Millennia ago, from the little cave on the tiny island of Patmos in the Aegean Sea, the heavens opened. Since then, the world has been fascinated by the cosmic upheaval brewing on the horizon of history. The upheaval is now upon us. It is within us. To some degree, it always has been. But there has been a sudden and violent shift in the affairs of the world. The winds have changed. Heaven will not be silent. Let's now join Father Anthony Bush, pastor of St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago, and author of A Mother's Plea, For the Winds Have Changed. Together we can pave the way for a hopeful response to the signs of our times.
And good Monday afternoon. This is Mary Helen Fiorito. I am the Cardinal Francis George Fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C., along with the De Nicola Center for Ethics and Culture at the University of Notre Dame. And it is my privilege, as it is each Monday, to be filling in for Father Anthony. Hope all of you mothers out there had a beautiful Mother's Day, despite the terrible weather we had in the Chicago area. We had quite a significant argument in the Supreme Court last week, impressive for all sorts of different reasons, the first among them being that people could listen in via electronic devices, which I think is the first time that's ever happened, as all the justices were working remotely, including Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who was in the hospital. And the argument in that was being put forth was the Little Sisters of the Poor case, which has kind of a complicated and lengthy legal history. I thought we were all done with this after the Supreme Court ruled on this a couple of years ago, but apparently not. And because of the complications constitutionally and otherwise, I really wanted to have an expert on the matter to talk through the issues, because I know this has been one of great concern for so many people, particularly those of us in the Chicago area. We have two wonderful large homes for the indigent elderly that are run by the Little Sisters of the Poor. They've been here in Chicago for more than a century, and to see them have to go away would impact literally hundreds of Chicago families who have nowhere else to send their indigent poor relatives when they reach a certain age. So I could think of no one better to discuss this with me than my friend, George Mason Antonin Scalia School of Law Professor Helen Alvarez. Professor Alvarez, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Mary, for having me.
It's wonderful to have you. This has been a great dream of mine.
Having our usual conversation.
That's right. Professor Alvarez and I go way back, so if we get off into the weeds talking about recipes and stuff, we'll check ourselves.
Yeah, somebody call in and stop us.
Yes, exactly. Well, Professor Alvarez, last week you had an excellent piece in the Wall Street Journal, The Endless War on the Little Sisters of the Poor. And listeners, you can find that on the Wall Street Journal's website at WSJ.com. It was posted on May 9th and is still up for you to read. But even prior to this case, Professor, there was a previous case that was heard by the Supreme Court. So for the value of our listeners who might not have been following this tangled hydra of a mess of this case, I can't think of anything. Greek mythology is where you have to go to find an analogy for what this case looks like. But could you kind of walk our listeners through the sort of the genesis of the lawsuit, what happened the first time the justices heard the case, and then why the sisters are back in front of the court again?
Right. So basically, during the Obama administration, there was health care reform passed. It said that they wanted to have one of the government agencies, Health and Human Services, define what were necessary preventive services for women. A highly partisan, like very Planned Parenthood stacked commission was chosen by Obama's HHS. they said that all FDA-approved contraception, including four drugs that HHS, under Kathleen Sebelius, admitted could cause abortions, were all mandated for all employers of a certain size. They exempted completely, like, dioceses, religious orders, parishes, but they did not exempt the vast numbers of Catholic institutions like hospitals, like healthcare, generally like social services, like halfway houses, and like the Little Sisters of the Poor. So the first case that goes up to the Supreme Court was actually a Protestant-owned family company that insists that it doesn't want to cover the four possibly abortifacient drugs and devices. They win very handily at the Supreme Court. It was called the Hobby Lobby case. And the court says, listen, clearly corporations have religious consciences. You know, institutions can have them. They violated yours. Under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, a federal law, you deserve an exemption. You have to have one. They left open the question of the second category in the healthcare law. People like the Little Sisters were what they called accommodated, not exempt, but it really was a bait and switch. What it is they required them to say, hey, we're not going to provide these things in our health insurance policies. Well, what you had to do was fill out a form, send it to the government, which allowed the government then to get the names of all your employees, and by the way, all their daughters of, you know, teenage years and older, and to attach to your health insurance plan, the Little Sisters referred to it as hijacking our health insurance plan, full coverage of these contraceptives and abortifacients, to send material to the people's homes that were your employees, to educate their teenage daughters, et cetera. And the Little Sisters said, no, this is not good enough. So they went back to the Supreme Court under, actually, the lead case was the Pittsburgh Diocese, the Zubik case, and they were one of the parties. And the Supreme Court says that, you know, we don't really want to decide this case. It seems to us that the government and the religious plaintiffs can receive, can get into an agreement. Well, the Obama administration never came to an agreement, just refused. Trump administration comes in, passes a law, provides a regulation, same health care laws in place, but they provide a regulation that says, no, religious entities are excluded. And in fact, so are entities that have a moral objection to these drugs and devices. Believe it or not, now we have the exemption, right? And I am embarrassed to say that states like my home state of Pennsylvania and states like California, they then say, you're not even permitted to give exemption. They are actually making the argument, and Justice Gorsuch really ran with this. If you give them exemptions, you are basically forcing other employees at the Religious Sisters' home to, quote, abide by their Catholic religion. So he basically, and let me see if I can make this argument plain to non-lawyers. This is like saying, every time the government creates a new right, hey, everybody gets free abortions. Every institution has to provide them. Everybody has the right to suicide pills. Every old age home has to provide them. That any religious entity that says no and therefore refuses to give that so-called benefit to its employees is actually in the business of, quote, establishing a religion, forcing the other employees. So what this argument is in the end is you may never give an accommodation to a religious entity because its other employees have to live by it, and that's like the government forcing them to live your religion. It's a really dangerous and broad argument.
Well, and it just, I mean, in the United States of America, and this is, I had to point this out, I was astounded, and maybe I'm just naive, astounded by some of the statements that were trending on social media, mostly on Twitter, the day of the oral arguments last week. I mean, people saying, if I go to work for the Little Sisters, they're going to shove their religion down my throat and I will have to live by their religion. And, you know, I said, you know, guess what? You don't have to work there. You can work any place else but the Little Sisters of the Poor. I just, you know, as a former diocesan employee myself, I didn't apply to work at the Archdiocese and then go in and say, you know what, I really need abortion coverage in my health care, and you don't offer that for me. It never would have occurred to me that I, as an individual employee, would have the right to dictate to a religious employer the benefits that they would provide to me. I mean, you know, every job that you take has give and take, has, you know, benefits and drawbacks. And, you know, you may work for, like, I mean, you know, as a lawyer, we've talked about this, that, you know, you might take a job like the one I had at the diocese, but you're not, and you make less money, but you're not working 14-hour days, 6 days a week.
Right.
There's trade-offs. Every person makes a trade-off. And it the number of people who argued that, you know, it was incumbent upon their employer to accommodate their religious beliefs to the extent that they would no longer be living out their mission. And, you know, the late Cardinal George had a very good saying. He said what this was, you know, prior to his death, well, obviously, but you know, when the first case was coming up, that what the government is trying to do here is to reduce religious institutions to their worship. You are only your worship. And never in the 200 years of our, you know, being in the United States and working here, never have we been reduced simply to our worship. We were always our worship and our mission. And and it seems like that's so last week. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. I think, at least for me, that was the first time I've ever heard an oral argument live.
Yeah.
Was it the first?
I don't think it was the first one. I think there was one the week. I think there were a couple of weeks before. But,
okay.
But this coronavirus situation is indeed the first time you've ever heard an argument.
Right. So that was very,
I think last week might have been week two, not week one of them, but I could be wrong.
Right. I mean, I've heard some of them. If you go into OEA and some of those other websites that where you can go back and listen to oral arguments, because I know they're all recorded, but to hear it in the moment was really interesting. And,
oh, it's so exciting. Oh. And you can also, you're hearing the, you know, sort of the passion in their voices regarding a particular issue. Right before we called this morning or this afternoon, I'm in the middle of listening to the case that's up before the court today.
Right.
And the argument is about whether a Catholic school has rights of control over who it hires, in this case, to teach religion. There's actually, these people are making, to say my blood is boiling, that they actually do not have the authority to allow people into the school and then control their employment, even if they're religion teachers.
The
theme that's going on here, Mary, between last week's case and this case, is that churches are sort of, they're really unwelcome discriminators in the public square.
The
theme is they're against women having freedom, which has been summed up in modern parlance as the right to have sex without children and therefore contraception and abortion. The emphasis in the attorney's arguments this morning is if you give Catholic schools authority to hire and fire their employees, including their religion teachers, you have given them a license to be cruel, to throw hundreds of thousands of people to the curb when it comes to non-discrimination laws, wage and hour laws, fair labor standard laws of other kinds. It's really presenting religion as a socially problematic anti-human being factor in society.
Mm-hmm.
That's really the sum.
Well, I've seen that, you know, just I checked Twitter just before I left the house this morning and to come to the studio, but it seems the hashtag Our Lady is trending quite heavily on Twitter. And just do you know the fact pattern in this case, just briefly?
The cases that are before the court this morning?
Yes, correct.
Yeah, I do. You have two different schools. In one case, they fired, in both cases, they fired teachers, one of whom was hired as a religion teacher. The other one, I think, in the Lady of Guadalupe case, was a religion teacher. They fired both of them for not doing their job well enough for various reasons. Both of them claimed that they were fired for other reasons. One said she was fired for disability, needing cancer treatment. The other one claimed she was fired on part of age. The schools hotly dispute this and say they have the record to show they were fired for not fulfilling their responsibilities. The actual claim, the Ninth Circuit, the sort of wacko court of appeals in California.
The most overturned circuit in the U.S., correct?
Exactly. Yeah. And in fact, Justice Ginsburg overturned one of their opinions last week, which was amusing. The court actually held, and this will make people's blood boil just a bit, that even if you're a religion teacher, you are, quote, like just reading words out of a book, unquote. When you take the children to Mass, you are just keeping order. When you do prayers every day and before each of your classes, you are just reading words on a page. And therefore, you are not someone who teaches or passes on the faith.
Wow. You don't even know where to start with that particular.
You don't even know where to begin.
Right.
And Ginsburg and Sotomayor in this case, Les Kagan, because she actually has a better religious freedom record than these others.
Mm-hmm.
They are basically saying, you are stepping on, and the attorney for the fired women keeps saying, hundreds of thousands of employees of Catholic schools and other religious schools. And are basically allowing these schools to have a free-for-all. What's actually a bit disturbing to me is I usually really love the Beckett Fund. The Beckett Fund does enormous work. Their work on behalf of the Little Sisters has
been tremendous, yeah.
But I am not happy with the lines they drew in the Supreme Court's argument this morning.
Hmm.
In my view, and if you look at Catholic theology, everyone who works at a religious institution is supposed to be there to promote the faith.
Correct.
And if you actually look at the sociology of religion and the very best sociological texts about how religion is actually passed on,
mm-hmm.
it turns out it's not by words, it's by lives.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm thinking of my kids in the Catholic school down the street and how influenced they were by in the afternoon, and then they were at aftercare for an hour. My son was always talking to the guy who cleaned the halls.
Yeah.
And they were always talking about this, that, and the other thing. The receptionist in the front, when the kids were sick and you'd pick them up at school and they'd be sitting with them, is having conversations about life and faith and life and the school. To me, unless you allow the school to make the determination of who passes on the faith and doesn't, and some people aren't going to. Somebody may be hidden away with a computer in the back room and not be in contact with people.
Right.
Somebody may strictly be handing food over a counter and never talks to the students.
Right.
But the cook who's making fish on Friday or who's trying to cook in ways that respect the environment or local food or an affordable meal for kids who need it, I'm telling you, they pass the faith on.
Right.
And I feel that Beckett sort of sold those people down the river today.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. We'll get into that a little bit on the other. We're going into our first break, Professor Alvarez. So let's get back into that on the other side of the break, because, you know, not to overquote Cardinal George here, as I tend to do during the show, but, you know, one of the other points he made was, you know, Catholic schools don't exist to express generic values. Catholic schools exist to pass on the Catholic faith to Catholic children. Of course, we welcome anyone who comes to us for education. We will educate anyone who comes to our doors, but they need to realize, in the same way the Jewish day schools exist, you know, we have quite a few of them here in the Chicago area. They exist to pass on the faith and the culture of those religious beliefs, to kind of inculcate those into all parts, as you point out, and like from having fish on Fridays. I always used to say there's nothing in a CCD program, after school religious education program, that can mimic in any way going through Lent in a Catholic school. I mean, it's just, you can't even describe it. So let's just go into our first break, Professor Alvarez. And I hope you can stay with us over the break, and then we'll get back into the conversation about the Little Sisters of the Poor.
Sure.
All right, everyone. This is Mary Fiorito. I'm sitting in today for Father Anthony here on listener-supported Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
The First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution is quite clear about the freedom of religion not being abridged. And yet, by executive order, only 10 people can attend a Sunday service in a house of God, even if that church has a capacity of 1,000 people, even though the attendees abide by social distancing. That's ludicrous. By executive order, your Sunday attendance is considered non-essential. And even now, the Little Sisters of the Poor have to defend their religious freedom. Again, Winds of Change will have periodic programs on the defense of our religious freedom. Stay tuned to Winds of Change. During this COVID-19 virus pandemic, offering you prayer and inspiration through your faith.
The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
Because of the unprecedented COVID-19 virus pandemic, the Providence Soup Kitchen at St. Stan's needs your immediate help. The Soup Kitchen is asking for your donations of water, juice boxes, individual food servings, hand sanitizers, and Lysol. The Providence Soup Kitchen at St. Stan's is operating regular hours during this pandemic. The Soup Kitchen is operated by the Daughters of St. Mary Providence from the basement of St. Stanislaus Kloska Church, which serves over 21,000 meals per year. To offer your help, please call Sister Darlene at 773-870-2435. That number again is 773-870-2435. Thank you. Pray the Chaplet of Divine Mercy with us at 3 p.m. Central Time, streamed live from St. Stanislaus Kloska Church, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago. Go to the St. Stanislaus Kloska Church Facebook page and pray with us daily at 3 p.m.
Have mercy on us and on the whole world.
Unfortunately, Mary Fiorito's scheduled guest, First Amendment attorney Eric Niffen, who was to talk about the First Amendment and religious freedom, will be rescheduled. We'll let you know when that will happen on Facebook and on Winds of Change.
And welcome back. Well, that was a perfect lead-in. Professor Alvarez, what in the particular diocese you live in, are you...
Washington, D.C.
Yeah, what permissions do you have in terms of being able to practice your faith inside a church building right now?
No more than 10 people.
Okay. Yeah, we don't even have, in Chicago, we don't even have that yet. And I don't mind things like marijuana dispensaries, which are legal here for recreational purposes, and liquor stores and et cetera, et cetera. But if people can go into a marijuana dispensary 20 at a time in the store and they stay apart from each other and they're doing no one any harm, I do not understand why some Catholic churches and dioceses did not fight to be named as one of the essential the essential businesses or essential services that are being offered to a state. So again, you know, Catholic Charities food pantries can remain open. We've been reduced, we're being reduced to certain things, either to our social services when the state needs that or to our worship when the state doesn't want our social services around.
Well, I think my first statement is I get it why they don't want these large gatherings. Second, they can and should allow for smaller gatherings. And what they've done here, and I think more than 10, you know, I don't know the absolute number. I'm not a scientist. But the at least the 10 person has allowed my parish, which is very close by, they have adoration every day from 12 to 3. And you go in there and there's people.
Yes.
And there's confession.
Yep.
And the priest is now hearing confession 6 days a week.
Wow.
Easter Vigil Day, Easter Sunday, adoration for even longer. So people were in and out all day.
That's fantastic.
And really, I noticed it did tend to stay at really low numbers, but I could, you know, even for me, and I'm sure for so many people, just the smell of the building, the sight of the altar, the monstrance, it's just so wonderful to be in the church itself and to bring your family by for a visit.
Right.
That has been a good exception.
Yes. And, I don't want to be reckless. And obviously, you know, our obligation to charity is also one where we don't put other people in harm's way.
Right.
And this seems to be an incredibly contagious virus, and many of our priests are over the age of 60, so you don't want to endanger anyone. But, you know, I know D.C. is a lot like Chicago. We have churches that easily seat 800 to 900 people. And I just don't understand why 10 or even 15 people sitting, you know, three or four pews apart could possibly, you know, pose a danger as long as people are wearing masks and they're wearing gloves and they're taking all the normal common sense precautions. It was an interesting, I don't know if you saw the piece in the New York Times, I think it was, where Mitch McConnell had written a piece on this particular issue. And he said, you know, we really don't have to be named as essential because the First Amendment's already taken care of that. For us, so because we're already, but it would have, it, when we are not sort of listed, it does kind of put in the public mind
that whole idea of where religion sits. You know, in the beginning of the United States, the descriptions of Madison, who's my all-time favorite founder on this question, Jefferson, who sometimes I'd like to take some of his writings and kick them around the room, which is really annoying. But even Jefferson, they all said, listen, what is religion? Religion is the duty that we owe God and the means of fulfilling it. Hmm. And these have to be allowed because God has created us to respond to these demands freely. So even Jefferson talks, his rationale for a political civil religious freedom is actually a theological rationale, that God has created us with certain duties and obligations that we have to fulfill, and therefore religious freedom. Madison is even stronger on this. The understanding was religion is the center of things, and society works its way around it. Yeah. And that is not going to be recovered in the U.S. You know, we're not going to do that in national way, I think. But it's true for so many of us that not even to acknowledge it and then to say the opposite is very problematic.
Yeah. And, you know, it's if Twitter and Facebook and Instagram are of any indication, you know, we really have not taught the Constitution well to our current population, because the misunderstandings over the First Amendment in particular is, you know, is really something. But let's get back to the Little Sisters of Poor. You know, I have a tremendous personal affection for them because, as I mentioned at the outset, we have two quite large homes here in Chicago run by the sisters, one in the city, one in the city proper, and one in a suburb called Palatine, which is in the northwest suburbs, that I think between the two homes, there's well over 1,000 residents, and and the sisters are, they have private apartments, and they also have, you know, then their assisted living centers. So when you combine all of those things, because they're on the same campuses, it's a significant part of the care. And of course, as you well know, but for listeners, for those of you who don't, they only take you if you're indigent. Like, you can't be a wealthy person and go to the Little Sisters of the Poor.
Right.
Unless you give them all your money beforehand, and then you're poor, and then you can move in with
them.
Then
you'll be indigent.
Yes, then you're indigent, and then the sisters will take you. But, you know, they exist to serve the poorest of the poor. And, you know, for them, it was interesting. I had a couple of the sisters on because we were celebrating their 125th anniversary here in Chicago specifically. And they said, you know, they really didn't want to talk about the case. They said, we exist, the term Little Sisters of the Poor doesn't refer to our stature. It refers to our desire to remain hidden and unseen, and we don't want credit for what we're doing. All we want is to be able to do our work and to do it well and treat every resident. And this was Mother Julie, who's the superior of the house in Chicago, St. Mary's. She said, we treat every one of our residents as if it was Christ paying us a visit. And she said, we are a family. And, I mean, it brings tears to your eyes. The dedication of these women who want no attention for themselves unless they're doing it for their elderly poor. You know, that's what their founder, St. John Jugan, said. You know, I will do anything if it means that I will be able to help another one of my elderly poor. So they were in front of the court last week, and I listened to the arguments. And, you know, it was, I wish no ill will to Justice Ginsburg. I hope she recovers. There are many things about her feistiness that I admire, for all sorts of different reasons, but I was quite disappointed, Professor Alvarez, in her line of, questioning to the attorneys arguing. And, you know, in particular, it felt to me like it was like a Planned Parenthood press release I was reading.
Did it
have that ring
to
you?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes, and she had more of an advocate activist tone and content, and it was, you know, we should be shocked by that from the court. We should.
But we're
not anymore.
No, well, it crossed a line, I thought.
Yeah.
And
well, let me tell, I'll tell people exactly what she said, which was she very impassioned voice goes, we are tossing these women to the wind. Congress wanted them to have free contraception, and this is a gigantic exemption. It goes too far. You are tossing the women to the wind. So several things going on here. Number one, she is assuming that contraception has been this great boon for women. There's so much evidence about when you dissociate sex from marriage, how women's desire to be married, to have a faithful relationship, to have a good dating relationship gets compromised. But set that aside. Then she made the legal misstatement, completely legally wrong. Congress desired women to have this. No, Congress said give them preventive health care, and a Planned Parenthood Guttmacher Institute weighted body at Health and Human Services voted for these drugs and devices, the contraceptive and abortifacient. So, no, it was never Congress. It was a politically motivated group. Third, Congress on its own if you actually look at what they did do and also look at what HHS did, they exempted tens of millions of people from getting contraception for free because they grandfathered a bunch of plans who did not have to include it. Those plans had to include other things that Congress considered important, cover kids till they're 26, don't exclude for pre-existing conditions. It did not cover contraception. So if Congress did anything, it indicated to tens of millions of people that contraception was optional. Hmm. Second, they exempted all companies, I think it was under 50 employees. Third, they created a whole bunch of other exemptions, and if you look at some powerful politicos in California, New York, and elsewhere, they exempted major corporations who just weren't ready yet.
Right.
So when you really ask the question, it's Justice Ginsburg's question should be flipped upside down, which is not why, you know, this exemption throws women to the wind, but why all the people along the way who made these many exemptions just didn't think contraception was important enough. And, of course, it's not. Like, 90% of plans covered it before. Mm-hmm. You had absolutely no grassroots movement of women saying, oh, I can't get mine free enough. Any woman can get it free from one of the government programs. The Trump administration has even expanded the Title X contraception program so that if a woman can't get it from the Little Sisters, she can get it elsewhere. It's contraception is so ubiquitous. And then it's so ubiquitous that it is nothing but a proxy for a political game about who's going to claim they stand for women and who's going to claim the other side hates women.
Yeah, and, you know, it, and that kind of, her, she starts with this premise that you know, never got, I don't know, questioned in my mind, that contraception is good for women, where we know there is so
right.
much research, and this was something I saw trending on Twitter, too, that, you know, this is it's akin to men not getting Viagra when they need it or men not getting vasectomies when they want them. And, you know, and when you look at it, just sort of logistically, the fact that a woman is infertile is an indication that something in her body is not working and therefore needs to be corrected. Whereas when she's fertile and able to have children, that's a sign that she's healthy. So you're taking a healthy system and disrupting it with contraception, which is most often hormonal. And, you know, again, this is where I think so many women have been misled, either by their doctors or by, you know, advocacy groups like Planned Parenthood, that somehow contraception is a good that benefits them when we know in so many different ways it doesn't. I was reading an article in Psychology Today, in fact, that was talking about how being on an oral contraceptive, if you're a single woman, can impact your choice of mate. And it will lead you to choose someone who is more biologically like your father or your brother than it will lead you to choose a mate who is biologically compatible with you. And I know you've done
well,
a lot.
Well, and that is just all so medically true. And everything you say is now more in the secular press than it ever was before.
Right.
And it's not just us religious types who are saying this. Nope. There's books about it. It's in the New York Times. It's in the medical journals. And, you know, I just want to point out to people, I just think this is such a definitive point. People have heard of the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, which comes out with the recommendations for the country about how much of this and that you should eat and when you should get your mammograms. I mean, all the doctors operate according to this huge task force, which puts out all this stuff about what's appropriate preventive care. Do you know that since the Obama administration in 2011 announced contraception as preventive care, they have refused to include it?
Hmm. That's interesting.
We're going on 9 years now. Wow. Isn't that interesting? Because it's not just that it's not preventing disease. It's actually associated with all kinds of side effects and problems.
Right.
Depression, et cetera. I mean, not every woman, but on average, it has more problems than women who don't. You know, women who don't use it will be better off.
Right.
Health-wise, mentally. Over the long run, you stick synthetic hormones. It changes the shape of your brain. It changes function in particular areas of it. And this is you and me reflecting on secular research, not what the church does.
Right.
In fact, I think the church takes too little advantage of this.
Well, you know, the World Health Organization has classified hormonal contraception as a class one carcinogen. And
right.
I tweeted a couple of things like that, and people said, you know, you're looking at quack science. I'm like, no, I said, this is from the National Institutes of Health. It has nothing
exactly.
And Psychology Today, you know, the actress Ricky Lake, who is pro-choice and very vocally so, but even she did a documentary, you know, based on that book, Sweetening the Pill, how American women got hooked on hormonal birth control and how damaging it's been to them. And, you know, I remember reading in the New York Times, there was a study of male hormonal contraception that was quickly curtailed when I think less than 3% of the men began to show side effects. Where, you know, 3%.
And, you know, yes. It's very funny.
Yeah, whereas American women, up to 50% of them have significant side effects from hormonal contraception. So it's, but again, to speak out against it, you're going against the orthodoxy of the sort of radical feminist movement. And Lord forbid, you know, we actually raise a science-based question. But anyway, so let's go back to, so we started with, I believe Justice Ginsburg had one of the opening, if not was within the top three of the questions. Can you walk us through who was arguing for whom for each party in the case? And then
In the Little Sisters case.
Yes, please. And then how the case unfolded.
Yes. In the Little Sisters case, we had Paul Clement arguing for the Little Sisters. Who's this amazing and very famous Supreme Court litigator. We had Noel Francisco, Solicitor General, arguing on behalf of the Trump administration, which wants to preserve the religious freedom of the Little Sisters. And then they had an attorney who was arguing on behalf of the state of Pennsylvania, made me very sad, my home state, arguing on behalf of the governor there. I can't remember his full name. Their argument was actually such a, you know, sort of legally technical argument that I don't want to go into any detail here. In broad strokes, it was that the Affordable Care Act's language mandating preventive services for women did not permit any exemptions at all. You had to give them. And this was actually quite hysterical because Justice Alito comes in and goes, wait, well, then the Obama administration's exemptions for Catholic dioceses and other religious entities would also be wrong. And then the guy had to quickly backtrack on that. Actually, because there were exemptions made by the Obama administration in the law and then in the HHS regulations themselves. So they were trying to make a really ridiculous argument that the text of the health care reform law itself did not permit exceptions. And I think it's very weak. Noel Francisco and Paul Clement were absolutely excellent.
They were.
I have to say, you know, I've listened to a lot of Supreme Court arguments, including some arguments today, and they are marginally, by many statistical deviations, standard deviations, better than other people. It's just amazing to hear them. Not just that their answers were on point and brief, but that they were so confident and so quick
they
and
were.
Didn't stumble.
Mm-hmm.
The Little Sisters should have been ecstatic.
Yeah. I thought it seemed to me that the argument did seem to sort of trend in their favor. And what did you think of the questions posed by Justice Thomas? I always find it so interesting because he never used to ask any questions. So I listen now particularly, you know, diligently to him.
Yes. So Justice Thomas is famous for not asking questions at all, even sometimes years and years go by. Apparently, he really likes this new system on the radio where Justice Roberts, going in order of seniority, calls on members of the court in order to ask X number of questions for X number of minutes. And it was clear that Justice Thomas was very, very, very skeptical of the Pennsylvania argument that the law on its face did not admit of any exceptions at all, because after all, the Obama administration had already made some. Thomas was really, really good on this. Alito, and again, it's a little too legally technical, but at one point, the image that I had of Alito's questions is that he had the Pennsylvania Attorney General on the head of a pin, and he was just sort of gently pushing it into a wall. And he caught him on a legal technicality that I would enjoy talking with you, but would bore the heck out of your audience,
right.
So I won't go into. But he caught him absolutely out, and the attorney knew it. It was awesome.
Yeah. And well, you know, the most, I have to say, the most watched justice during that time, or most listened to, because no one could really watch, was the questions posed by Justice Kavanaugh. So, I feel very sorry for him, because I think no matter what he says, It's going to be skewed in a certain way to be unfavorable towards him personally. And that's a, you know, it's a real cross I think he has to carry. What were the questions that he posed, and what do you have a sense of what particular part of the argument he was really trying to explore?
You know what, Mary? I think I forget what I have my notes somewhere here in my desk about what Kavanaugh posed, and if I had thought about it in advance, I would have them very close to me, but I don't think I do. Yeah. Let me take a quick look. I'm going to flip one pad here and see if I have it. I do not have it.
Well, you know what? We are actually...
I could tell you chapter and verse what Kavanaugh did today, but not last
Okay, well, you know, it's exactly. It's been a long for it. All of this
quarantine... A long week.
Well, all of this quarantine is just one day running into the other. But, you know, Professor Allery, this is a good moment. We're going to take our final break. So why don't we go into that, and then we'll be back in a minute or two to finish up our conversation about the oral arguments at SCOTUS last week regarding the Little Sisters of the Poor case. This is Mary Fiorito. I'm sitting in today for Father Anthony here on listener-supported Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
Because of the unprecedented COVID-19 virus pandemic, the Providence Soup Kitchen at St. Stan's needs your immediate help. The Soup Kitchen is asking for your donations of water, juice boxes, individual food servings, hand sanitizers, and Lysol. The Providence Soup Kitchen at St. Stan's is operating regular hours during this pandemic. The Soup Kitchen is operated by the Daughters of St. Mary Providence from the basement of St. Stanislaus Kloska Church, which serves over 21,000 meals per year. To offer your help, please call Sister Darlene at 773-870-2435. That number again is 773-870-2435. Thank you. Pray the Chaplet of Divine Mercy with us at 3 p.m. Central Time, streamed live from St. Stanislaus Kloska Church, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago. Go to the St. Stanislaus Kloska Church Facebook page and pray with us daily at 3 p.m.
Have mercy on us and on the whole world.
The Winds of Change. The Winds of Change. On AM 750, WNDZ.
As we sit home or are doing the necessary and often courageous jobs for your family and others, Father Anthony invites you to be with us Sundays, where you will see the English, Spanish, and Polish Masses on the St. Stanislaus Kloska Facebook homepage. St. Stanislaus Kloska Church will keep you updated via flocknote.com or by texting the word Kloska, spelled K-O-S-T-K-A, 2-845-76, or via the St. Stanislaus Kloska homepage on Facebook, plus the parish website, ststanschurch.org. Keep listening for more information on Winds of Change, Monday through Friday at noon on AM 750. As always, we ask you to lift your voice to God, our rock and our shelter.
And we're back. This is Mary Fiorito, and I'm interviewing Professor Helen Alvarez today. She is a professor of family law and contract law. And Helen, what else do you teach?
I teach law and religion, property, and family law.
Oh, very good. Okay, property. That's the one I forgot.
You have such
an extensive resume, but thank you. You've been so generous in giving our audience this time. And you know, we were just talking about some of the questions and the sort of tone of the argument. Do you know who I heard? I heard real frustration from Justice Roberts, and then a little bit less so Justice Breyer, about why can't these two sides work this out? Why are we back here again hearing this case?
Right.
Did you feel that sense of frustration?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I did commentary for C-SPAN, and one of the things that the ACLU and I agreed on was this going to turn into another of the prior case where the Little Sisters were involved, the Zubik case, where they send it back and say, come on, you guys, come to an agreement. I have some real misgivings about this for this reason. The come to some agreement indicates that somehow the government has a point that contraception is some crucial, significant, must-be-free, women are dying because they don't have it kind of service. That really troubles me.
Yeah.
And the way that Justice Ginsburg and her dissent in Hobby Lobby and the way she spoke of it during the oral argument and the just their entire behavior throughout the case, you would have thought that women actually couldn't get it. I mean, anyone who wants to read my article about this, it's on SSRN.com, which is the free social science research network, and it's called No Compelling Interest.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about, and I just lay out all the facts and data about the country is awash in cheap contraception. It was a political point, not a medical one, and not a point about women.
Right.
And the arguments that Breyer, or the suggestions that Breyer and Roberts were kept making about, can't you just come to some agreement? I wanted to say, listen, you know, everybody can have, you know, two methods a day, 365 days a year. The little sisters and others do not need, there is no health or other really serious social interest such that they should move toward the government on this.
Right. I mean, you know, the people were making comparisons of contraception to, for example, like vaccines. You know, say you're working for a particular religious organization where they don't believe in vaccinations. Will you not be right. able to have vaccines covered by, I mean, like you say, the very fundamental and foundational issue of whether or not this is really necessary health care. And
right.
whether or
and,
not...
And the reason why that vaccine thing, Mary, along with, you know, would religious organizations have to obey race non-discrimination laws, et cetera, the reason why these things are being raised by the other side is the so-called parade of horribles. I will make your position look like it leads to the end of the world as we know it.
Right.
In fact, the way a religious liberty claim is structured, the religious complainant says, you're burdening my religion.
Mm-hmm.
If that's the case, which usually that aspect is easy to establish, the government then has to say, listen, we have a compelling interest that allows us to do so, and we are realizing our government interest by means least restrictive of your religious freedom.
Right.
If the government can show that, you can burden religions. Religions do have to go along with stuff they don't like. We don't have a get-out-of-jail-free card.
Right.
What the court never got to, and I'm not sure they're going to get to it in this case either, is does the government really have a compelling interest for burdening the little sisters?
Mm-hmm.
I know the answer is no.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure the court needs to reach that point in order to decide the case before them.
Right. And that's, you know, that's a tremendous frustration, because I think if it were any other topic, you would have seen real in-depth research presented that would show,
yes.
you know, X number of women will die every year if they don't have access to hormonal contraception.
Right.
And, you know, like, so 2 points. One, I just looked up to, I was curious as to how many people in the United States now get their insurance through their employer, because prior to Obamacare, it was a fairly significant percentage.
It's still a significant percentage.
Yeah,
you know, I don't know the numbers, but people didn't want to go on the state's plans. They weren't that great.
Oh, no, they're not. Places. Yeah. And I went and looked in the Kaiser Family Foundation, which is not friendly to the Catholic Church by any stretch of the imagination, said only 49% of Americans now get their health insurance.
Really?
It's less than half now. And unfortunately, what triggered that tremendous drop? So employer-covered health care is sort of going the way of employer-covered pensions right now,
mm-hmm.
because those were the norm, and now they're not. Now people have to do it independently, although, you know, employers will match. Or, for example, if they don't cover your health care, they might give you a stipend so that you can go on to the exchanges. But when Obamacare mandated that any employee who worked more than, I think it's 34 hours a week, correct me if I'm wrong there, 34 or 35 hours a week, automatically mm-hmm. had to be covered by the employer. I know all sorts of people who worked in grocery stores, who worked in restaurants, who were immediately cut to that number. They were immediately cut to 34
yeah,
a week.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And told, you cannot get any overtime, because if we give you overtime, then we have to cover your health care. And it became a way where the working person once again suffered because of something that was supposed to provide, you know, justice and health care for all. And for many working people who had good plans, you know, through their Kroger, you know, grocery store health insurance, because they worked 40-hour weeks, no longer have it. And they're out on the exchanges where they're probably paying higher premiums and everything else. So you know, in many ways, I know Obamacare did provide health care for people who might have been shut out. But you, when you have 49% of people who get their health care from their employers, and then the rest are Medicare and Medicaid, they're people who are on military insurance. And then I think only between 13 and 15% of people are actually out on the open exchanges. But so that's kind of like point one. But point two is, you know, so the specter of, you know, thousands and thousands of women, if the Little Sisters of the Poor case is favored, you know, is ruled in favor of them, won't have access. It's not going to impact as many Americans as one would think. But secondly, I believe this argument was made, none of the employees of the Little Sisters of Poor have ever asked them for contraception.
Well, you know, one of the things that I pointed out in an editorial in the Wall Street Journal, and I wrote about it also in the National Review the next day, is that the state of Pennsylvania has never, not once, nor the other states involved in the litigation, come up with a woman who claims she can't get contraception somewhere,
right,
free or affordably.
Yeah,
they simply couldn't come up with someone. And yet, the basis for the states having what lawyers call standing, that is an injury that gives them the right to sue, they claimed that they were just going to be overwhelmed on their state exchanges with all of these terrible cases of women searching for contraception somewhere,
right,
who couldn't get it from their employers. And it was just going to, the number of college students in religious schools and the number of these religious employers, and they could never find one.
Yeah.
And I mean, if you actually look at the programs, it's Medicaid, Title 10, community health centers, something called SPRAN, Special Programs of Regional and National Significance, Title 10, which is now expanded so that you don't have to be poor in order to qualify if you can't get it through your employer. Honest to God, you know, they do everything but put it in the water in poor neighborhoods. Contraception is not scarce or expensive.
Exactly. And as you, I think you pointed out in your Wall Street Journal article, and again, listeners, I would really recommend that you go back and read that on the website. You know, you have organizations like Planned Parenthood and NERCS who will, you just go online and they'll mail it to you. You don't even have to leave your house to get it. That's how, and 9 times out of 10, it's going to be subsidized. So, it's interesting, you know, when you meet the people who work at the Little Sisters of the Poor, I was looking at some online comments, so many of them saying things like, you know, we don't want to hurt the sisters. We don't want to see them close. This is like a family, you know, and maybe my benefits aren't the best. I don't make a lot of money, as many people who work in nursing homes don't. But this is like a family, and the sisters treat us with such love. We don't want to hurt them, and we don't want to see them go out of business. But so, Professor Ellery, get out your magic ball and look in, and what do you think the outcome of this case is going to be here, if you had your crystal ball in front of you?
Yes, I think the Little Sisters are going to win. I say this with always cautious optimism, because if not, you don't deserve your lawyer spurs. And I think the court will find that it has always been the case that even, you know, all kinds of congressional statements, you know, are subject to not only exceptions, but also that every single federal law, including the healthcare law, is always must be interpreted in accordance with the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, another federal law that says all federal laws are subject to me.
Yes.
So the idea that agencies are forbidden from taking the law of religious freedom into account, they are forbidden from granting exemptions that federal law requires, just seems too plainly ridiculous to me. Pennsylvania really overstepped here.
Right.
And I think they'll find that this is perfectly consonant with the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. There's another standard that applies to when regulations are interpreting a law from Congress. The regulating agency, in this case Health and Human Services, cannot issue arbitrary and capricious regs. Well, darn, arbitrary and capricious. The feds have been sued by 300 religious institutions in 100 lawsuits. God knows what the taxpayers have spent just to force the Little Sisters to provide this sort of thing.
Right.
And how could it possibly be arbitrary and capricious? And they've lost most of those lawsuits, by the way. And how could it be arbitrary and capricious for them to say, we recognize we lost in Hobby Lobby, we know what the Supreme Court said in Zubik, we're going to issue regs that are in conformity with what the Supreme Court's going to do to us anyway.
Right. But I mean, well, what's driving this then? I mean, I'm asking that rhetorically. Is it the advocacy?
Well, let me tell
groups?
You. Yes. Let me tell you, and you probably know this. There's a guy named Michael Weir who was Obama's liaison with evangelicals. He wrote a book when Obama left office about, he was there, I think, almost a full 8 years. And he was present in the conversation where apparently Joe Biden, who calls himself Catholic, Leon Panetta calls himself Catholic publicly, were in the office with President Obama, and said, we got to back off on this Little Sisters thing. You know, this is killing you with the Catholics. Mm-hmm. This is a ridiculous, this is in 2012. You know,
right.
you just, and Obama's, Weir reports in his book that Obama's presidential campaign advisor said, no, it's a way for you to beat up on Mitt Romney and say he hates women.
Mm.
And for that one reason, Obama sided with him and kept it.
Yeah, well, I was glad.
It was nothing but politics.
Yeah, and that's the, you know, again, the money wasted, you know, with the sisters. And the sisters, it's funny, you know, I'm glad that the attention has been drawn to them and to their good work, because they would never draw it to themselves. And, you mm-hmm. know, I do hope that it motivates people to, you know, to donate to them and to volunteer with them.
Yes.
But tell me, so just kind of overall in the few minutes that we have left, Professor Alvarez, this is just one of a number of different religious liberty issues that the courts, like, for example, the case today, what else is sort mm-hmm. of on the horizon? You know, so say there's a, whatever, a 6-3 or a 5-4 split in the Little Sisters case. What will this mean for the future of religious liberty in the country?
Yeah, I mean, it's not good that what we all think are common sense interpretations of either the Constitution or of the federal legislation, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, often hang by a 5-4.
Yeah.
Now,
is that where
the ministerial?
Do you think that'll go?
Pardon me?
Is that where you think this case will go, Little Sisters?
I think it's possible it'll be 5-4, 6-3.
Okay.
I think we could get possibly a Breyer or Kagan
mm-hmm.
On the question of whether the federal health care law itself allows the Trump administration to
Kagan's question surprised me. I was, you know, it's funny. You would think Sotomayor would be the one who would have been the more sympathetic, having gone to Catholic schools. But it was actually mm-hmm. Kagan.
Yeah, Kagan, if you actually look at her record, even when she was in the White House, she has always had a more religious freedom protective side to her.
Yeah.
And I do believe she's one of the smartest members of the court. I certainly don't agree with everything she does. But I have her writing, her questioning. I'm, you know, as a lawyer, I'm a Kagan fan.
Yes.
As a pro-lifer, I think she gets it totally wrong on that.
That's true. But, you know, again, you do get the sense, and I think that's sort of where, like, the Ginsburg sort of, you know, blindness because of their own personal opinions. And I hate to say that, because Ginsburg, in a lot of other contexts, is a very fair judge, but that the she has blinders on this particular issue. Her friendship with Antonin Scalia notwithstanding, which I was always grateful to see.
But so she has mistaken the contraception and abortion as a women's crusade, and that's her main. She was brilliant on her women's crusade to get equal protection for women, and then it all went awry when she substituted contraception and abortion as a proxy for women's freedom.
Right. And well, so what else are there? Any other cases that we should be watching that are coming up that will deal
well,
with
the Beal and Our Lady of Guadalupe cases that were argued today will also be out at the end of this term, and that will be very important regarding the scope of religious institutions' right to hire and fire their own employees who do mm-hmm. or do not serve religious mission. There's a case coming in the fall about my hometown, Philly, and whether or not they have a foster care program run by the church there that would not put foster children into same-sex partnered households, and the city put them out of business.
Mm-hmm.
And that is going to be a really great religious freedom question as well.
That's happening.
And I suspect Masterpiece Cake, I can't even remember, and I should know this, whether Masterpiece Cake is headed on its way back to the court.
I think it is. And then the florist case as well.
Arlene's Flowers,
right,
yes. And
right.
The court was able to dodge the precise religious freedom question. Does a person who does an expressive, decorative, speech-related thing
right.
for a wedding have the right not to facilitate, support, cooperate with a same-sex wedding? They were able to dodge that question, but not the next time.
Okay. Well, Professor Helen Alvarez, thank you. The time flew by. What a great gift to have you with us for this entire hour. Thank you so much for sharing your
Thank
time
you.
With us. All right. And listeners, You can see Professor Alvarez's Wall Street Journal article at WSJ.com. Have a great week.
What's there to say when the world makes no sense? Do we search deeper truths or sit on the fence? Can you see? Can you see? Can you see the winds have changed? We marvel and flatter such meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide.